It's season 3, episode 3 of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Gita Pensa. Welcome back, everyone. Recently, I gave a talk at a defense counsel seminar. So a room full of defense attorneys, risk managers, claims professionals. And anytime you get that group together, the same concerns will surface: an increasingly predatory malpractice climate, aberration verdicts, broader erosion of public trust in healthcare that directly affects juries. There's a lot. There's a lot to talk about. Now, coming at this as a physician, I offered a different way of thinking about these issues through a public health lens. So, in medicine, we know that just treating one patient at a time, while essential, is not enough if we want outcomes at a population level. The same is true in malpractice litigation, right? Defending one case at a time is totally necessary, but it's not sufficient if we want to move the needle on all of these problems. Now, to my mind, public health focuses on prevention and harm reduction. And it starts by defining a problem, identifying risk factors and protective factors, developing testing interventions, and then engaging stakeholders to scale what works. That framework matters here because we have a population-based problem with lots of different stakeholders. I mean, I think about the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 1980s and 90s. Like, I trained in the 1990s in an urban environment, and I saw day after day after day just extraordinary devastation. PCP pneumonia, cryptococcal meningitis, Kaposi's sarcoma, day in, day out, day in, day out. And today, most trainees will never see those conditions. And that transformation did not happen because of just one breakthrough. I mean, yes, antiretrovirals mattered, but before that had to come very significant advocacy and awareness and legislative pressure and research funding and treatment access and a shift in public perception, right? This took a public health approach aimed at both harm reduction and cure. And it began with a small group of people getting louder and refusing to accept the status quo. And that's why today I want to talk about advocacy. Because yes, we need a sort of public health approach to this very large problem that I've spent, you know, 3 seasons of a podcast so far talking about. Its impact on the healthcare workforce and the health of America at large. This matters. We need to change the climate around medical malpractice litigation. This is not a system that serves patients or clinicians well. There are many, many pain points, many stakeholders, and many people who need to be persuaded that reform matters, not just for doctors, but for everybody. So when people hear the word advocacy, they often think of lobbyists, professional organizations, people with formal power and access. But to me, it starts a lot smaller than that. It starts with simply putting action to your hopes. It is deciding not to passively accept a system that predictably harms people, and instead asking, what part of this can I influence? I mean, as we've talked about in healthcare, in malpractice litigation, we see the same pattern after adverse events. We see silence, fear, blame, prolonged legal battles, and outcomes that leave patients and families and clinicians worse off, right? We treat this as inevitable, but it's not. And so advocacy can look like pushing for better communication and resolution after harm. It can mean examining how your own institution responds to adverse events, or creating peer support around them, or calling your legislators and asking why our legal system so often rewards delay and polarization and suffering over truth and healing. And, you know, sometimes advocacy looks a lot quieter, right? This podcast is my form of advocacy, using the skills I have, the experience that I've lived, the conversations I can facilitate to try to educate us, educate clinicians, attorneys, insurers, the public about what actually happens inside these systems and how they could work better for all of us. Right? You don't have to do everything, but each of us can do something. And when enough people choose to engage thoughtfully, persistently, with integrity, and maybe a little loudly, that is how systems begin to change. And it is true that the more you do, the more confident you become, and the easier speaking up gets. And not long ago, I was invited into a room at a very high-profile, multi-specialty medical organization, and they asked me, what are all the changes I would like to see in malpractice litigation reform? And I kind of laughed because I'm not sure I've ever put pen to paper and thought about those things. But they said they really wanted to hear. So I did that. I took 10 minutes and I wrote a list. It's not even a complete list, but it's pretty long and there are far-fetched things on it. And so yeah, it's a wish list. Now, this being the holiday season, I actually thought that maybe you would like to hear a little bit about my wish list. It's very long. I'm really going to put more of it in the show notes, but here we go. Dear Santa, I have been a very, very good doctor this year. And I was hoping that you could bring me a few of these things. Now, if you're feeling really generous, I would like total medical malpractice reform in the United States, including a no-fault system or state-based compensation funds, healthcare-specific courts, and specialized judges. I realize that might be too much to ask for, but I have some other categories of wishes, and here they are. They're categorized, for your convenience, into policies that protect our healthcare workers and patients and create more timely resolutions, and attorney-centered reforms, and expert witness reforms. And they include things like wishing for a similar legislation to Utah HB 503 for all states, or strict criteria for punitive damage demands, or federal protection for the mental health records or emotional support for healthcare workers, and requiring Michigan model attempts at early resolution in every case, and caps on plaintiff's attorney contingency fees, and standards of professionalism for attorneys in deposition and trial, and here's one wish that I think that we can start addressing right now as physician leaders. Every employed defendant should get litigation leave for deposition, trial, preparation. We should not have to use PTO or make that time up. This is an occupational event, people. Act like it, okay? More on that to follow. But anyway, this is the beginning of my wish list. Dear Santa, I have been good. If you could bring me some of these things, that would be great. But I realize that Santa's probably not going to bring me these things, and we're just going to have to start advocating. That is what's going to have to happen. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce my guest today. My guest is Dr. Shilpa Mathew, MD, JD, who is here to talk about advocacy with us. Dr. Mathew is a Northern California physician. She's double board certified in OBGYN and lifestyle medicine. She's a formerly practicing attorney who spent the latter half of her legal career focused on health insurance and regulatory compliance. She has long been active in health advocacy and policy efforts, ranging from things such as pro bono legal work to protect the basic health rights of foreign detainees in U.S. prisons, to serving as a medical student delegate to the California and American Medical Associations, and research focused on the medical legal knowledge of residents. Currently, she serves as the co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in California, where, together with a team, she helps shape policy to advance women's health. I hope this conversation gets you thinking about maybe just one small way that you can be an advocate, that you can put some action behind your hopes for the way things could get better. One quick disclaimer, Dr. Mathew is here today expressing her own opinions and experiences and not the opinions of her employers or the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists. Dr. Mathew, MD-JD, you're here sort of with your medical and your legal expertise. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just by way of introduction, they'll have heard a little introduction about you to start with, but you were a lawyer first, and then you became a doctor, right?
Yes.
Okay. And what were you practicing legally?
So I originally started in the real estate industry with doing real estate finance, but then the latter half of it was done with a focus on health insurance and regulatory compliance during when the Affordable Care Act was actually passed.
And what made you decide you wanted to go to medical school?
I grew up with two physicians. So my parents are both ENT physicians. So it was always something that was in the house and, you know, well known to me. But I really loved the study of law, and it was, you know, a great field to work in. But I think ultimately at the end of the day, I went into medicine. Sounds kind of trite, but at the end of the day, to help people. And I think, you know, from a soul standpoint, that was something that really spoke to me and felt like a calling. And that's why I ended up pursuing it. And I've never looked back. It's been the right choice for me.
At what point did you realize that your physician colleagues did not understand the law?
I can't even tell you how hard it is. Tried to get people excited about it and, you know, in policy and advocacy work, which we're going to talk about in a minute. You know, I think we have a very head down, work really hard, learn the research, do the medicine kind of approach. It's a personality type, I think, also. Although I do think the new generation of physicians is looking more broadly at medicine in the business and legal aspects. But I think, you know, we're scientists by nature, and there's a certain kind of way that we look at the world. And so I think, you know, for a long time, we focus very much on that and not the business and legal aspect of medicine.
Yeah. We want things to make sense.
Yeah.
When we get into the law, we realize, like, why doesn't this make sense? We see some facts, and then there's all this spin on the facts, and what is happening?
Yes.
Right here?
The law is a completely different way of looking at a fact pattern than how we would potentially do it in medicine.
And it actually has, I feel like, a lot more in common with politics, which is what we're going to start talking about shortly. So today, what I'd really like to do, and would really like for your help to do it, is to get a really high-level view of where we are legislatively with medical malpractice and tort reform in the United States, and what we as individual physicians can do about it. I think we all sort of bandy about this term tort reform. We need tort reform, and we don't know what we're really talking about. And nor do we have any idea what we as an individual can do to support the reforms that we know are very, very badly needed. And we've missed some opportunities along the way to really sort of reform malpractice in the United States. I mean, the whole point of this podcast really is to demonstrate the fact that this is not the system that any of us deserve. And how do we move closer to a system that we deserve? So in theory, what would you say the goals of malpractice law have been historically in the U.S.?
I think this is one of the things to emphasize in terms of patients and providers really all want the same thing. And I think the goal of the law really has been to deter medical errors. We want to punish bad actors who are not doing the right thing. And then there's the concept of restoring the patient to how they would have been had it not been for the harm, and that there has to be some kind of fair compensation for those who have been harmed. But I think it's a little bit more straightforward, right, in a case like a car accident, which is also a type of tort, where there's a negligent accident. For example, the car gets injured, right? And then the plaintiff can say, hey, my damages or my harm is that I need a new car, and then you pay for that. But in, you know, the medical area or medical field, that kind of concept of harm and then reparation for that harm is a lot more complex.
So let's get back to the word tort, which is T-O-R-T, no E. This is not a dessert. This is nothing sweet about it. We've touched on the civil litigation process a little bit previously, but just to remind everybody, medical malpractice falls under the broad umbrella of civil litigation, not usually criminal, although we have wandered before into talking about criminal litigation, and we will do that again. But within the civil litigation arena, can you tell us, like, what is a tort? Tell us about tort law. Get back to basics.
Yeah. So there's four main elements that make up a tort. So the first is the duty. And so that's the doctor-patient relationship, and the doctor has to act in the best interests of the patient. And then the next element is called breach, and that's where you have to show that the defendant breached that duty. So that's when we look at whether the doctor acted or failed to act in a way that a reasonably prudent or similar healthcare provider would have done in that circumstance. And then the third part is causation. And so you have to show, but for the act of the doctor, the patient wouldn't have had that injury. So for an example is, you know, if a surgeon left a tool, let's say like a forceps inside the patient, and then the patient got an infection and then had sequelae from that, Then we show that had it not been for the tool being left in, they wouldn't have had the injury. And then the fourth part is the injury itself. And so there has to be something for which the damages can be awarded. So for medical malpractice, they generally tend to be economic and non-economic, with economic being things like medical expenses, potentially rehab after, lost wages if the patient has been out of work. And non-economic damages are going to be intangible harm, such as pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, emotional distress, and things like that. And occasionally, you know, there can be punitive damages for really bad acts. So one thing that comes to mind is if, you know, a physician knowingly operated while drunk or something like that. That's an egregious act for which something like punitive damages might be awarded.
And so we're going to get into this in just a little bit in terms of, in some states, there are caps on non-economic damages and there are not in others. I live in a state where there's no caps on anything. Let us talk about why it matters to have a malpractice system that works and is fair.
So, you know, I think there are a couple of main things. So the first is access, and that's very important. It's always been important, but I think right now in this moment, there's a lot of attrition in the workforce and people who have quit. And I think especially post-COVID, you know, the climate it is such, and there's a lot of healthcare deserts. And medical malpractice reform has shown to increase access. That is especially true in specialties that have higher malpractice risk. So that's one thing.
We have data to support that.
Yes.
I actually wrote a letter to the state legislature. They're talking about the physician shortage in Rhode Island and made this real case for malpractice reform and some changes being something that would actually help it out. We have, our state is ranked, whenever they do these rankings, we're ranked either 49th or 50th in terms of malpractice climate for physicians. And I'm like, you know what? If you're trying to bring a doctor here, this survey is open to anybody. And you see that a state is ranked 49th out of 50th for malpractice climate and our reimbursement's kind of low too. You're not bringing anybody here. What do you think? You know, but it didn't go anywhere. I'm going to try again. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about what else I can do to try.
That's what we were saying. Political climate, I think, is starting to shift.
Fingers crossed. Okay. So that's the effect that it can have on the workforce. What else is important about it?
You know, I think you've alluded to this in the podcast before, but I think, you know, there's a fairness aspect of this that I don't think is present in the current system. And as you've mentioned before, you know, the majority of doctors will ultimately win their cases. And so I think, you know, we do have to look at this current system and see, are we bringing the right meritorious cases forward? And I think what the data has also shown is that not only are doctors winning mostly, but there are sometimes cases too where there is an injury that should be compensated and is not getting. So I think fairness is an aspect.
Yeah. I often teach people that I don't think that we can say anything about the quality of medical care that was rendered based on a legal outcome alone. And certainly I've been involved in cases in the last few years where there have been these sort of nuclear verdicts handed down. And if you get a little bit of an inside knowledge of the case, realize that everybody was, you know, acting completely appropriately medically. And so you start to realize that we as society want a legal outcome to mean something about whether or not the care was good. And it doesn't do that.
So I think one of the other main things, which you have also talked about in the podcast, is that the cost of all of this is just astronomical. The way that we resolve disputes in the United States through litigation is very costly. And I don't know that it necessarily is the best way to facilitate healing. And I do think the concept of an injury to a patient then has to be compensated by money is, you know, more American, I would say, than is a value that's shared in a lot of the rest of the world. And that to restore an injury, money is not always the best way to bring healing and not always the only way to bring healing.
I do think that the cost of malpractice insurance, this is something that can drive providers out of types of practice. You know, obstetrics comes to mind. Make them leave OB practice and just do, you know, gyn because the OB is the higher liability side. And there's a lot of implications on the cost of insurance alone in terms of our workforce and getting people the healthcare they need.
Yeah. So definitely malpractice insurance premiums factor a lot into, you know, whether physicians are able to practice in a certain area. And like you mentioned, a lot of people leave the OB side of the OBGYN practice due to acuity and because of the litigation burden.
So you've presented us with some evidence, but first of all, what is MICRA? And what have studies of MICRA shown us?
So MICRA is a reform that's in California. So it's the Medical Injury and Compensation Reform Act. It was originally passed in the 70s and then updated in, I believe, 2022. And one thing, it's often considered the gold standard in medical reform in the United States because it's a multi-prong approach. So it's really kind of famous for its non-economic damages cap, but it does have other prongs to it. And I'll just talk about a few, but there are a lot. So it has an apology law aspect to it. So it protects communication between physicians and patients, especially after an outcome. And if physicians express some kind of sentiment of apology or sadness over the situation, then if it ultimately ends up in litigation, it helps protect physicians ultimately from those statements being used against them.
I know that we've got some conflicting evidence as to whether or not tort reform reduces healthcare costs. That's a whole other conversation because I believe it's really more about whether or not the doctor wants to engage in the legal system at all. It almost doesn't matter what caps are. We just don't want to get sued and we don't want to be wrong. And so I think that defensive medicine is going to continue. Tort reform, I feel like, could help the fear aspect, but it may not really reduce the amount of testing that we do. And so we'll see what studies bear out. Okay. So overall, the data that we have shows that, let me get this straight, that medical malpractice reform improves access to care for patients. It constrains the growth of medical liability premiums. It keeps costs down for insurance. It lowers the frequency of claims and reduces average payments of claims and sort of lowers healthcare costs in general. Is that what we've got?
Yes.
So then this seems like a no-brainer, except that somehow it doesn't happen.
We're still here.
Somehow we're still here. So you sort of alluded to some other countries. We don't have to go into this in depth, but what does happen in some other countries?
So I think we could use New Zealand as an example. There's a lot of different models across the world, but they have something called the Accident Compensation Corporation, which is a government-funded program and based on a no-fault idea. And it covers all personal injuries. And in that umbrella, we have medical and treatment injuries. So they don't have to show fault, but they do still have to show causation between the care and the injury. But the concept of negligence is not there. And once that is shown, then the system tries to provide comprehensive support with funding for treatment, rehab, other costs in exchange for the right to sue for damages. And funding is always, you know, an important concept in all of these models. And it's funded through taxes and partially through the government and income taxes, for example. And then they also have this other sort of pathway for personal accountability, where patients who are concerned about a particular practitioner's actions can file a complaint. And then that health and disability commissioner then focuses on investigating the complaint, mediating, and then really looking to the future in ways to prevent that harm.
Okay, so let me see if I get this straight. If there is a harm event medically and you live in New Zealand, the first thing that happens is, I'm sure there's some sort of investigation or whatever, but if there is payment to be made to the patient, it is not punitively targeting the doctor that assigned that care. It's just sort of, okay, we are deeming whether or not you deserve some sort of compensation, and it's going to come out of this fund that the taxpayers all pay for, and the physician is not targeted as an individual. But if it is something like we're worried there's a bad actor, there's a route for that, and that health and disability commissioner can investigate that and see if there's something that needs to be remedied, and hopefully look at less from a punitive perspective than a corrections perspective. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
That sounds like it would be a lot less intimidating and scary when you're thinking about how a physician currently can be judged in the United States if they don't have adequate coverage or there is some kind of nuclear verdict and they have to worry for all these years that their assets are on the line. I mean, the degree of stress that our current system creates is just as we've talked about throughout this podcast. So that is a model that, you know, I don't know that it's going to happen in the United States tomorrow, but just to realize like there are other ways of doing this that sound a little more fair to me. So a system like this, I think, is probably safer overall. I think most safety experts would endorse the fact that a no-fault system is probably more amenable to finding problems and correcting them. Is that true?
Yeah, so I think this model has been looked at, and I think it has been shown to encourage health providers to report mistakes. But I think, you know, there are downsides, right, to every model. There's always pros and cons. And some of the research has shown that though they've collected more safety data, it hasn't necessarily made New Zealand a safer health system than other comparative countries. And so I think, you know, I don't know that's necessarily criticism of the overall model, but maybe some direction as to what they should be actually doing with their data more concretely.
Okay. Well, it's certainly not worse.
No.
It is a kinder, gentler system.
Yes.
So I'd still be all for it. So we can talk, I think, at another time on a different podcast about other world models. People are certainly interested in them. They write to me all the time, sometimes from other countries, sometimes from, like, I have pen pals in, like, Australia and England, and people saying, I listen to your podcast and I cannot believe the way it is in the United States.
Yeah.
I just say, like, well, you know what? This is the system that we're working in. But can we talk about attempts that have been made on the federal level? We keep talking about the climate in states, but have there been opportunities to try to reform things at the federal level in a way that would affect all states in terms of tort reform?
So I think there have been many attempts and few successes, if I could be so blunt. But I think, you know, the bulk of the reform has been done at the state level. But, you know, a lot of reform was passed during COVID because it was a very interesting time. So there were a lot of protections passed for healthcare workers because, as we all know, we were greatly deviating from our usual standard of practice due to various factors associated with COVID. So there were a lot of protections there.
Yeah.
You know, there are other things like the Federal Tort Claims Act, which can protect, you know, particular healthcare workers in particular situations. So some, if you work at certain health centers, you get deemed part of the public health service, and then you have some malpractice liability coverage in that regard. So that, again, comes back to this, how do we encourage people to be in certain areas and provide access? So one other thing I think that's really interesting that was attempted, I want to say around 2014, was this concept of the safe harbor provision and, you know, protecting doctors that way.
Okay, tell me about that.
The concept was, and it was brought by some of the physicians who are actually legislators, who are U.S. legislators. And the idea is that there are set guidelines that you would follow in a particular circumstance. So we could use, in my, you know, field of medicine, say an eclamptic seizure, for example. So they would set a series of guidelines that would say, hey, if you had an eclamptic seizure, you should manage it this way. And that is the standard of care. And then the concept was then, if you followed that set of guidelines and there was an injury ultimately, but you did everything you were supposed to do, then there couldn't be a case. And so the way that that legislation worked, which is called a safe harbor, is that if there was a case like that was in state court, it could be ultimately removed to federal court. It could then be reviewed by doctors primarily or other parties who would be well-versed in that kind of a case.
Okay.
It could then be stopped if we felt like the standard of care was met.
Okay. So the lawsuit would be initiated. You would still have to go through some things, as we've talked about. But your attorney would say, like, this should fall under safe harbor, somehow try to get it moved to federal court. The federal court would enable people to review it and ultimately dismiss it if it seemed like it fell within that.
Yeah. And then it required, you know, big stakeholders, right? So the national societies for a particular field of medicine would then be setting that standard of what the case would be compared to.
So what happened with the Safe Harbor Act?
It did not pass.
No. Doesn't mean it's not worth trying again. But this is good to have some sort of idea of, like, what has been proposed in the past and thought to be reasonable enough that it would be something that, you know, potentially could be voted on or something like that. But I think that's a really interesting idea. Like, that could have been something pretty cool, but not yet. Okay. Everything is not yet. Not yet.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about what's happening in the states, because in some states have actually managed to pass some sort of local reforms. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So we've definitely had some very good efforts. And now sort of talking kind of concepts rather than necessarily actual laws, and maybe mention some actual laws, but there's the idea of, you know, good Samaritan laws. So those are the ones where, say, you stop, you're on the highway and somebody has a bad accident and you as a physician stop to help somebody who's injured. In the past, right, that patient per se could actually sue you for helping if something went wrong. And now there are protections for that. So that's one kind of reform.
Are there any states where that's not the law? Somehow in my head, I thought that was like a federal thing. I guess it's not.
There is federal law now, but at some point there wasn't.
Oh, I see. And so then it was up to the states.
Yeah. And then there's also the concept of dispute resolution. And it's kind of sort of similar to this concept of having health court or an expert jury kind of looking at the case. So Wisconsin actually requires a mediation type process before going to court. So a lawyer and a healthcare provider and usually a layperson look at the case and they look to try and resolve it before any kind of trial. And if that process fails, then you still have the right to sue and bring it to court, but they require this sort of pre-process to try and resolve things ahead of time.
And then there is some recent legislation in Utah that I'm particularly excited about.
Yeah. So I think the political climate was as such, and I think you've alluded to this in the past too, where plaintiff's attorneys were really pressuring doctors to settle because they would threaten to go after their personal wealth. And so this new legislation, I think, is an answer to that, where it protects a physician's personal income and assets from being seized in a judgment if they maintain insurance of $1 million.
All right. I can think of so many places where we need this legislation, but in Utah, everybody listen, if you want to pick a place to practice right now, head to Utah.
Yes.
Because if you carry $1 million in insurance coverage, they are not allowed to go after your personal assets. I mean, I think that's huge. If I was coming out of residency and I could go anywhere, I'd be like, I'm going to Utah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And how about Texas had medical malpractice and tort reform in the early 2000s, right?
Yeah. So they passed the Medical Malpractice and Tort Reform Act, and it's since been amended a little bit. But essentially, there's a lot of parts to it. But one of the ones I wanted to focus on was in the emergency rooms and in delivering emergency care. So there's a higher burden for plaintiffs to prove. So instead of ordinary negligence, they have to show willful or wanton negligence in certain aspects of emergency care in order to bring a case. And there is some, I'm particularly interested in it because it has some OB provisions as well. But I think the important thing about this, right, is that they're recognizing that there are certain types of medicine or situations in medicine that are different, right? And that you aren't necessarily able to talk about the risks of something when you're providing emergency care, and that things can go differently in these circumstances.
And willful and wanton negligence, will attorneys just try in the beginning to say that this was willful and wanton negligence just to sort of make their case more valid, and then they'll have to back off? Is that what happens?
I don't know, because I only practice in California, but probably is my guess.
But that is at least a higher bar. And so even though you may have to go through this whole thing to prove that this was not willful and wanton negligence, at least you can sort of rest thinking like, I have to go through some things, but in the end, this would be very hard to take to a jury because a jury is going to recognize that this is not what they're calling it.
Yeah. And as I understand it, the number of suits brought in that context have gone down drastically after the reform.
I mean, again, going back to the settlement thing, I think what people really need to understand is this tactic of using pressure to get a physician to settle, if that is within the physician's purview to decide if they're okay with a settlement. Because, you know, the screws can get turned pretty tight. And if you don't understand what your risks really are, or strategically how this whole game is played, I mean, what they're after is a settlement. It's that they live on a steady, rich diet of settlement dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And so all they have to do is say, you know, like, we're going after you for, you know, gross negligence standard, or we're going to try and get your assets or whatever. And physicians, it rightly so, inspires great fear
right
among us, because we know that this is adjudicated by a jury that doesn't understand medicine for the most part. And what if? Yes, please take my insurance policy. I'll settle for policy limits. Let's go. So the more that we can ward off that kind of behavior, this is why I think that Utah is brilliant, the better off we're all going to be, in my humble opinion. So the most common reform, though, I think, among states that have it, I believe, is this capping of non-economic damages.
Yeah, over 30 states have imposed that. And the original law in a lot of the states has been updated for inflation costs and things like that, but it has been one of the most successful types of reform.
And that's where we get these giant nuclear verdicts in some places. I mean, as I've mentioned before, like the initial demand, in my case, they just mentioned a number in like the 20s, millions of dollars. And this is in 2007 or whatever. And because I live in a state with no caps on pain and suffering. And so it was not just the economic damages, there were wages lost, and then there was loss of consortium. And they blamed a lot of things in this person's life on me, and she was young. And so, you know, the numbers just kept adding up and up and up and up. It is truly terrifying. And I think in some states, what there is an effort to do is to create like generational wealth. This is no longer just compensatory for the injury at hand, but they make it, you know, these sort of fantastical projections about like this person was going to be an NFL, you know, star. And look, they were going to make all these millions and millions and millions of dollars, and their children would have been entitled to XYZ. And now they won't, you know, how do you put a price on that? And they do put a price on it, and it's something like $100 million.
Yeah.
So you can probably tell by the way I'm talking.
Yes.
General degree of upset that I have about the current situation. And there is also this feeling, I think, that many physicians have. First of all, we don't understand the system well enough to learn how to strategize within it or to advocate within it because we just don't understand it. And two, there is a certain degree of passivity among a lot of doctors that don't think of themselves as leaders or whatever. And so we complain a lot about there being no tort reform. And yet we as individuals do nothing about it because we just say like the powers that be aren't helping us.
Yeah.
So let us talk about this for a moment, shall we?
Yes.
Yes, it's true that the plaintiff's bar is very strong. I know. And they're one of the strongest lobbies in the United States is my understanding.
Yes, yes,
but
yes.
But that doesn't mean that like every legislator is in their pocket, I don't think. And it doesn't mean that we can't exact change that is reasonable when we demonstrate the harms that the current system are exerting on the people of the United States in general.
Yeah. And I think the existing legislation, you know, has been incredible wins in a lot of different ways. And that's a testament to that, that we can actually make change.
So what can we do? This is your wheelhouse, this is the advocacy. But what can we do?
Yes. So I think, you know, there's a couple ways to get at this. And so I think the first thing is to talk about it. And I think you've alluded to that a lot in the podcast about how we're very hush-hush about, you know, the things that happen to us. And there has to be a sense of normalizing of it. And part of that, right, is spreading the message that bad outcome does not always equal negligence.
Say it again. Amen. Amen. Say it again.
Amen. So bad outcome does not equal negligence.
Yes.
I think it's a cultural problem and I think it's a systemic problem. You know, and I have an example and I was sort of debating whether to use it or not because it's a very gruesome case. But I don't know if you heard about that case out of Georgia where there was a really bad delivery outcome and then ultimately the baby passed away and then the way that the baby was delivered was in parts.
The decapitation case that everyone knows about.
Yes, the decapitation case. And so I think the way that it was portrayed in the media in terms of how could this ever happen, and it's horrible, it's tragic, you know, just so sad. And it was worsened, like the pathologist that was hired then put some of the autopsy pictures on social media and stuff. So it kind of became the circus. But I think how the public perceived that kind of event happening, I can tell you every single OBGYN in the country that heard about that had a very different response, right? We all have this, oh my God, that is the worst possible situation in one of our worst emergencies, which is shoulder dystocia. And I can tell you that all of us have talked through that scenario. Like when I was preparing for boards, we have to talk through exactly what happened in that case because it is unfortunately last thing that we have to do for the health of the mother in that kind of circumstance.
This is a technique that you learn as obstetricians that may have to be deployed in a worst case scenario to save the mother's life, but it's not something that no one has ever heard of if you're an obstetrician.
Exactly. And I don't have any comments on whether there was negligence in that case because I don't know the facts, but I just want to make the point that you know, what the public understands of that kind of circumstance is not necessarily the way that we in medicine would look at it, because we know that there's a grim reality that sometimes that is the last thing that we have to do. And thankfully, most of us will never see that in our lifetimes, but I do know practitioners who have.
So I think we need to be, again, hammering home this point that a bad outcome does not equal negligence. It is tough in the social media era. You know, I work with physicians where they've been maligned on social media. I've worked with hospitals where, you know, documentaries have been made to vilify them. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult scenario to be in. And this is a whole other conversation I want to have with a defense attorney at some point, being like, why this no comment stance? Like, is this really the best way for us to go when, you know, they're just hammering us left and right in ways that aren't consistent with what happened in reality? And, you know, can't we do something else about that? That's a whole other discussion.
Yes.
You know, you're right. I think that this is something that we need to be talking about more out loud. And we are going to have to bring lay people into these discussions. Like, it's one thing for us to talk amongst ourselves, but we've got to be able to wade into this in public, which is tough because people are mad.
Yes. I think there's a big disconnect between, you know, what we sort of take as truth and reality, and then what the public actually knows and understands. And I could give you another example. So on TikTok, for example, an OB anesthesiologist talked about doing a 24-hour shift and then the fatigue that comes with that. I can't tell you the amount of outrage that was, you know, in the comments towards her about how, you know, you can't make an excuse of being tired after 23 hours and it's unreasonable, it's unsafe, you know, that you're working these kinds of hours. And so I think it was sort of an aha moment for me of like, well, half the medical system works on that kind of work model, right? And then the public really does not know, you know, the way that, you know, medicine necessarily functions.
They don't understand how medicine works. Yeah. So yeah, social media, absolutely double-edged sword. So, okay, we want physicians to talk about it locally, broadly, with lay people, with patients, trying to explain, you know, this concept that bad outcomes do happen in medicine, and we need to learn how to accept them in another way besides trying to vilify or, you know, extract money from the system. What else can we do?
So I think we have to get around this concept, too, that humanity makes mistakes. And I think there's this level of perfection that we put upon ourselves, frankly, as physicians, and that the public expects from us. And I think there's a lot of things that go into that, right? I think we're all perfectionists by nature, you know, in general in medicine. And then we have these things like M&Ms where we then hammer out, you know, when there was something that happened in a case, how do we make it better? And in general, those things were built for safety, right? But ultimately, they can get quite antagonistic. And I think you have also touched on the fact that experts then will testify in cases to standards that are completely unreasonable to meet. I always say that if we cannot treat ourselves with humanity, the idea that we are going to make mistakes, how then can we ask the public to treat us that way? And so I think it's a twofold approach, right? We have to acknowledge that we can be our own worst enemies.
And then really just be able to give ourselves grace, because medicine's not a perfect science. Like, we're just operating in the gray a lot of the time, and we judge very harshly. But then when it's you're the person operating in the gray, then you actually understand it. So how do doctors learn about these issues? We were just like literally skimming the surface. If doctors wanted to learn more about these issues, what can we do?
You know, I think we can build it into our educational system, so both in medical school and in residency. And I think you touched on it in terms of how the ACGME can address these issues. But one of their core competencies is systems-based practice and professionalism domains, and medical legal education and medical malpractice education can come under that. And I do think, you know, in my observation, just in my time in medicine, there's been a lot more efforts towards health policy electives and residency elective time and addressing these issues from an education standpoint, but we definitely can do better.
And if we want to get involved legislatively, what do we do?
Yeah, and I was going to say that's the million-dollar question, and I think it's one of the most important pieces and also one of the most difficult things to do.
I mean, we have a lot of excuses, right?
Yes.
Sometimes it's like, oh, people just want us to give them money and like, I'm getting paid less than ever. And so I don't have the money to give, or, you know, this would take time. I'd have to take time on my practice day and I can't because I am really busy. And so we're all busy and funded less than we were once upon a time. And then like nothing will change unless what?
You touch on one thing that's important, which is I think that physicians have to value this, and our institutions also do. And so I think we rely very much on volunteer work in these aspects of medicine. And I think there has to be more provision, both in physician schedules and potentially by the systems, to either pay for the efforts for physicians to go out and express their voices, or at least give time for it. Because our schedules are very busy and we have a lot of clinical duties, and it's hard to make these hearings at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon to share, you know, a patient story. So I think that's one important aspect. But in terms of actually getting involved with changing the law, that really comes down to lobbying.
Okay. How does lobbying work?
My best advice to physicians is to get involved in organized medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So that means like your county medical society, your state medical society, specialty organizations, because they're going to be the most well-versed at this process.
Basically, they need muscle to help them, and they need boots on the ground to help them, but they know how to do it.
Yes, exactly. So you can do individual efforts, right? So your legislator is ultimately responsible to you as a voting person, and so you can email them, and that's relatively easy to do. You can set up appointments with legislators to talk about issues that are important to you. But organized medicine is really going to understand the process of how all of that is done and be able to do it more effectively.
If you really just say, I don't have the time, I don't want to make the time, just funding the political action committees, expressing your concerns to those groups and telling them, like, these are the things that matter to me. We need these things addressed.
Yeah. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, right, some people are too busy and this isn't their interest, but do support the efforts. And so you can support the people who are doing the work. And I think, you know, maybe going through one passage of law as an example would explain, you know, how lobbying is very intricate and complicated. So one other way that people can get involved is in this concept of policy setting. So the American Medical Association, for example, has a lot of policy on medical malpractice and a lot of tools and resource kits and things that people can refer to. And then in states like mine, such as California, there's a lot of policy from our state medical association, you know, that can be used as models for people in states with poorer reform. But the reason that it is important is that when a law is ultimately being passed or questioned, the way that our legal system works is going to look to prior precedent. So in general, right, we're going to look at the way that other laws have been passed and those kinds of things. But policy setting can really be persuasive. It's considered a secondary source when we're looking at law change. And so if the emergency physicians group has policy on a certain issue, that's going to be persuasive than if there's a law being passed on that issue.
I see. Okay. So getting involved really into sort of policy setting in your own organization, that's something that'll carry weight with legislators to say, like, okay, look, this big group has a policy statement around this, and we should consider that when we're thinking about making laws.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way for medical students to get involved, because a lot of the state medical associations, you can be a delegate or an alternate delegate to them. And then you set these things called resolutions. And then if they're ultimately passed, they become policy. It can be a great way for the younger generation to get involved in this topic as well.
So what would be some examples of things that we could push for? We've talked about some examples of legislation that have been tried before and some things that are happening in some states. Sometimes we feel like we're just making things up out of whole cloth. Like, what do we ask for? We ask for the moon. Like, what's reasonable to do?
So I think it's sometimes hard to say, hey, push for this kind of concept, because I think we want to look at the whole story, right? And we don't want to lose the ground that we've already made when we are pushing for something new. And I don't know about you, but I'm like, I just want to blow the whole thing up and, you know, it start again.
I want to move to New Zealand.
But, you know, we have made some significant grounds, like I could say in California, with this kind of reform that's been effective. And so we want to make sure that we preserve that as we go forward. So I do think, you know, there are a couple ways to approach it. So one is to look what we can do locally. And we talked about educational reform and all of that. But I think you've touched before on early resolution programs. because those can be done locally. They can be done within a system. And I do think one thing that's helpful to understand, too, is that you've covered the Michigan model, which ultimately seeks to resolve the case entirely. But there can be more informal places in which the provider and patient can meet, where they get access to records, you're able to talk to each other. And that especially works in states where you have these apology law protections, because the studies have shown over and over and again, right? The patient wants to understand what happened. They want an apology. And so sometimes these informal programs where you just can sit down together, review what happened, talk to each other can be very, very effective.
And then looking towards broader reform, what might be hoped for in the future?
Yeah, I think in that way, we have to look at what the gaps are in the reform that we currently have. And I think, you know, there's a couple themes there. So I think there has to be acknowledgement of the systems part in it. So I think often the doctor is held liable in many cases. And there are a lot of things that are, you know, systems based that play into that. And I do think, you know, we've talked about this before, but the concept that there are many things in medicine that are outside of our control. And in other areas of law, like in contracts law, for example, there's this concept of there was an act of God or force majeure. And they say that you're let out of the duties in your contract because there are things that just happen. So for example, if you are trying to get a product from a buyer to a seller and then Hurricane Katrina happens in the middle and they can't do it, we say, hey, okay, you know, we're going to relieve you of your duties. And there may be a remedy in the end, but ultimately, you know, and I think that kind of thing can be applied to medicine, right? Because I think there are things that are outside of your control as a provider, and you can do all the right things and still not get the outcome that anybody wants. And so I think there has to be some acknowledgement of the fact that that is a part of medicine in reform.
Yeah, I like that concept. I think that's really helpful.
I think the last thing to mention, you know, aside from the costs, which we've talked about, that has to be addressed more, I think. But I do think, you know, we have to have a better way for suits with merit to go forward. I think that's established in the research. I think there's a lot of harm that's done by the system the way it is. And so there has to be a way for us to bring suits forward that should be, right? Because I think we're all aligned as patients and providers that we want bad actors to be punished, but then not pull in all these, you know, frankly, innocent people into these really stressful and time-consuming situations.
Yeah. The system we have now, it doesn't work for anybody, honestly, but the plaintiff's bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right about that.
I think one of the best ways to look at reform is to approach it, you know, just like MICRA does, where we're looking at different aspects of the problem and passing a law that addresses a lot of those aspects. And that kind of reform can be more successful, I think.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you have a really big and complicated problem, there's usually not just one magic bullet that's going to fix it. You know, if you have a patient with diabetes, you can't just say like, okay, you know, this insulin alone is your answer. I mean, there's got to be exercise. There's got to be, you know, talking about nutrition. You've got to talk about muscle use. You've got to talk about all this stuff. All of these things can help mitigate the problem. And so just thinking about all the ways in which we can do our part to mitigate it, I really emphasize that with anybody. Like, whatever it is within your little sphere of influence, you know, I'm not a super lobbyer. I mean, I give money and I write letters and things like that. But what I thought I could do is teach people about this.
Mm-hmm.
So this is me doing my part here, trying to educate people about the issue. And I can't do it by myself, right? And so there are a lot of people now who are saying like, okay, let's make this part of a curriculum. Let's make this part of what happens in medical school. We just need to keep talking about it more and more and more. People will feel the push to sort of self-identify as leaders in this area. But malpractice reform has sort of fallen off of the conversation, I feel like. And we do have other fish that need to be fried. I get that prior auth is a problem and insurance companies are a problem. And
yeah.
Oh my gosh, like there's so much going on right now.
Yeah.
But this also matters. And so we need to keep talking about it. I know everything is tough right now. I can't overstate that.
Yeah.
But let us keep trying. Let us just keep walking in the direction.
Yeah. And I think we've made a lot of strides and meaningful reform has been done, but I think our work remains unfinished.
Or we'll all just move to Utah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Matthew, for bringing us this just sort of call to action. Everybody, please get involved. I know you're doing your part. for obstetricians in California. Thank you for coming and talking to us about this. I hope that we continue to have conversations about advocacy as this podcast goes forward. But this was a really nice high-level introduction to like how and why you should get involved. And I appreciate your time.
Yeah. And I really want to thank you for all your efforts. It's been so inspiring.
Thank you, Dr. Matthew, again, for coming to talk to us about advocacy. I wish each and every one of you a wonderful holiday season. I will see you in the new year. And hey, we've got work to do then, so stick with us.